Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace and love.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, friends and listeners. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. Good afternoon, Maria. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Jim. I'm great. How are you?
I'm in good shape. I'm in pretty good shape anyway. Yeah, let our listeners know what they're in for if they stay tuned.
All right. Well, I'm excited about our show today. First, we'll be speaking with Marcy Winograd about a bill that's flying under the radar here in California. And if passed, it could have devastating consequences to our freedom of speech and political dissent. A lot of what we talk about here on KPFK even. And then in our second segment, we'll be speaking with Eduardo Lalo Vargas about a political party that's not one of those two big ones. And that is the Party for Socialism and Liberation. So we'll hear all about what that is.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, let's get started. I think we've already got Marcy on the line, ready to go.
I am ready. Let's go.
All right. Well, as I said, we're going to be talking about a bill today. It's known as AB 715, and it's being fast-tracked through the legislature with almost no public oversight. The bill proposes vague and expansive definitions of the word discrimination, and it opens the door to criminalizing discussions of U.S. foreign policy, especially concerning Palestine and Israel, all under the banner of, quote unquote, fighting anti-Semitism. And if passed, AB 715 could also codify censorship, threaten ethnic studies programs, and even punish teachers who want to promote human rights and liberation struggles. To discuss all that is at stake here, we're so fortunate to have with us Marcy Winograd. Marcy coordinates Code Pink's Drop the ADL campaign and also organizes with Educators for Justice in Palestine, a grassroots caucus within United Teachers of Los Angeles. Marcy has been sounding the alarm on AB 715, not for what it says only, but also how it was pushed behind closed doors with gutted and amended tricks that bypass the usual public process. She's also no stranger to electoral politics herself, having mounted a powerful primary challenge to Jane Harman back in 2010, and she served as a Bernie Sanders DNC delegate in 2020. Marcy Winograd, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much, Maria and Jim. I'm really honored to be your guest today and very anxious to talk about these backroom deals and what this bill could mean for educators and students throughout California.
Right. And time is of the essence. So let's get started with the basics. AB 715, what's it about? And why are you calling it a threat to classroom freedom and union democracy?
AB 715 has in it language to amend the California Education Code to redefine the term nationality, to say that nationality would also include a person's actual or perceived shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics or residency in a country with a dominant religion or distinct religious identity. And you might say, what does that mean? And, you know, I think it's purposefully ambiguous and written in kind of a convoluted way. What they are trying to do, and they being the Israel lobby in California with the Legislative Jewish Caucus spearheading that lobby in the California legislature, what they're trying to do is sneak in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition and examples of anti-Semitism that conflate opposition to Israel as a state that privileges one ethnicity over another into the definition of anti-Semitism. Interestingly enough, although it talks about how it talks about anti-Semitism five times in this bill, yet it never defines it. And I think that's very purposeful because they're going to define it later. As they said, I was just listening to a hearing in Sacramento in the Assembly Education Committee on the bill. And Dawn Addis, one of the principal co-authors, she's an assembly member on the Central Coast. She was clear. She said, this is just the beginning. We're going to amend this a lot. She was very explicit about that. And I mean, that was my gut reaction when I read this, because it seems skeletal in some respects, although it has a lot under the banner of intent. In other words, if you vote for this bill, you are saying as a member of the assembly that you pledge to establish an anti-Semitism czar. What is that? That would be somebody who would have authority throughout the state over California schools to monitor content for anti-Semitism. If you think that will only deal with anti-Semitism as a byproduct of white supremacy, I'm afraid you're mistaken, because the purpose is to erase Palestine, erase Palestinians, censor discussion of genocide in Gaza, U.S.-backed Israel genocide. And it could have far-reaching ramifications for other genocides as well.
You know, also, this bill doesn't just target content, does it? It seems to criminalize content as well, does it not? I mean, what does it mean when legislation uses vague terms like promotes discrimination, especially when tied to political discussions around Israel and Palestine? How dangerous is this ambiguity in the bill?
I think it's very dangerous, especially as they talk about amending the California Education Code without sunlight on this bill. When they talk about establishing a czar over anti-Semitism, it's clear that the purpose of this bill is not to protect students, not to keep students safe. The purpose is to shield Israel from its crimes against humanity. And I have to say, I was aghast listening to the hearing underway in the Assembly Education Committee. This hearing is chaired by Al Muratsuchi. He's an assembly member from the Torrance area. He is running for the state superintendent of schools position. He allowed those who supported the bill, I mean, there were probably over 100, talk endlessly about their stories. But when opponents, and there were well over 100 opponents, come to the microphone to talk, he cut them off. I mean, people started shouting, and he threatened to kick them out of the hearing room. But that's how it started. And he consistently cut off opponents. It was shocking, really shocking, because if that's how he wants to oversee the schools, he's tipped his hand. He will be the state superintendent of censorship.
Yes. Oh, goodness.
And I wanted to say this too, because you mentioned, Maria, the backroom deals. Just to clarify, I mean, even if you're a member of the assembly and you don't know who to believe or what to think and can't really decipher this ambiguous language, the procedural grounds are substantial enough for voting this down, because what happened was, a little bit of backstory, you know, the Israel lobby tried to introduce a bill. Well, they introduced a bill called AB 1468, and that was to police ethnic studies. And there was tremendous opposition because the bill said that educators were not to discuss the causes of the marginalization of their students, and they were not to discuss international affairs, just keep it to domestic affairs. Never mind, you know, the Atlantic slave trade, just talk about, I don't know what's happening in their hometown. And, you know, it had other aspects to it that scholars called racist. And when California Federation of Teachers, UTLA, United Teachers of Los Angeles, CTA, California Teachers Association, came out against it, suddenly the authors of that bill said, we give up. We give up. We're going to assign this to the waste bin. And what they did was they got Rick Chavez-Zabur, who represents the area from Santa Monica into Hollywood, to basically gut. Yeah, he gutted a previous bill. That is the bill we are looking at right now, which is AB 715. And that bill initially was on attorney discipline. Well, all of that was taken out. It has nothing to do with attorney discipline now. It is this bill to pledge to establish an anti-Semitism czar and to redefine the meaning of nationality to shield Israel. That's what we're looking at now. Now, in addition, They didn't just gut and amend a bill, which really is in violation, at least in spirit, of the California Constitution, which says that a bill has to be introduced at least 30 days prior to its first hearing. Well, if Zabur introduced his attorney discipline bill in February of 2024, he can then gut it in May of 2025, and they can schedule a hearing on the bill less than 72 hours later, which is also a violation of the assembly rules. They can create a deadline for a submission of opposition letters that occurs before the submission of the amended bill. So when you read the summary of the critique from the Assembly Education Committee at the end, it says no opposition was submitted. That's what we're talking about.
What could have been? Yeah, right. Yes. Goodness.
So, I mean, Trump couldn't make this up, right?
No, I know. I'm sorry, Maria. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, from a movement perspective, what does all of this rushing through and the lack of notice, what does it say about who holds power right now in Sacramento, and how should unions and educators be responding?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and that the unions should be responding as they responded in the past to AB 1468, the Police Ethnic Studies Bill, in that they came out strongly against it, mobilized against it, testified against it, and it went into the waste bin. And that's what we have to do now. Of course, the unions weren't notified in time to have any kind of democratic process to analyze and discuss this bill. That, however, can change and will change. And my understanding is that the president of the California Teachers Association is testifying today in Sacramento. You know, I'm with you now, so I'm not listening to him, but he has concerns. We all, you know, educators have concerns. We don't want to have to feel straitjacketed in our classrooms. And that's not the avenue to educating our students. That's the avenue to censorship and to dumbing down the, you know, watering down a curriculum.
Yeah, I have two questions before we get lost in this, because it is so critically important and it's all happening so fast. When, in fact, is the actual vote on this supposed to take place now? They've been rushing everything.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
So yes. Having already violated all sorts of rules, they're going to put a cap on that and or put the frosting on the cake, or however you want to call it, and actually try to have a vote on it tomorrow. Well, before we let you go, we're going to ask you to let our listeners know how they can perhaps target certain legislatures about their opinions of this. But what I wanted to ask you about next was that you've been organizing with Educators for Justice in Palestine and pushing for a California State Teachers Retirement Fund to divest from Israel. Your position on this is well known. How do campaigns like that tie into the backlash we're seeing now? For example, is AB 715 part of a broader attempt to shut down growing solidarity, and it is, with the Palestinians?
I have no doubt that it is, but I don't see that as being successful. I think educators, well, certainly those who are voting members of the House of Representatives of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, these are by and large elected representatives, see genocide for what it is and have overwhelmingly, I mean, 90%, 95% voted for resolutions, motions to divest for CalSTRS, the largest teachers pension fund in the world, to divest from companies that are complicit in war, occupation, genocide. I'm talking about, for example, CalSTRS has almost $200 million invested in Lockheed Martin, making F-16, F-35 attack jets for Israel's genocide. It has almost $200 million invested in Boeing, over $200 million invested in Caterpillar, which is destroying Palestinian homes to build settlements. It has $70 million in Palantir, or $80 million in Palantir, which is a company that has a huge contract with ICE and is to provide surveillance of immigrants for Homeland Security. So we want to get out of CalSTRS. We want CalSTRS to divest of this. And there's a statewide effort called CalSTRS Divest, and UTLA has decided to support it as well, for good reason. So, you know, they can push back all they want, but they're losing the war for public opinion in our schools and certainly within our youth.
Let's talk about the weaponization of the term anti-Semitism. You've been very clear, anti-Semitism indeed exists. but conflating it with anti-Zionism is confusing and disingenuous, and it's being used as a tactic to stifle legitimate debate. So why do you think the terms anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are increasingly being used as if they're the same thing? Because I remember a time not so long ago when they were pretty distinct. So, and also, how are you and others pushing back?
Sure. Well, Maria, the Israel lobby, and by that I mean a whole constellation of organizations. So, for example, the Anti-Defamation League, which is pushing out contemporary anti-Semitism lessons that specifically target Jewish Voice for Peace, American Muslims for Palestine, and say that protesters are smearing Israel and they are the enemies of the people. We have the Anti-Defamation League, we have Jewish Family Children's Services, Jewish Federation, on and on. And this whole constellation, what I would call an ecosystem, working in conjunction with the entertainment industry, working in conjunction with Lockheed Martin weapons industry, they are desperate to continue for whatever reason they have, you know, for the weapons industry, this is a bonanza, right? The genocide in Gaza. For the Israel lobby, they are intent on silencing the debate. So for them, this is the way to do it. This is the way to do it, to conflate, to say, if you oppose Israel as an apartheid state, if you question whether it should be a state that privileges one ethnicity over another, which promises birthright citizenship to every Jew in every corner of the globe, but denies the return, the right of return to Palestinians and their descendants who were exiled in the Nakba in 1948, then you are an anti-Semite. And I think they feel this will be effective, and that's what they're pushing. They're not just pushing it in this country, but worldwide, because the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance is as a group of 30 countries, I think 35, that have come up with this disturbing list of examples. And, you know, I have to hand it to Bernie Sanders. I don't agree with him on everything, but he together with Ron Paul, kind of a libertarian Republican, together they basically gutted this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act that came up in a committee in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate. And Bernie introduced a motion to cut out from this list of examples all examples that had to do with Israel. In other words, to detach anti-Semitism from identification with the state of Israel. And Rand Paul was there with him, as was Chris Murphy and a few others. And the Republican who was chairing, Cassidy, I think he's from the South, he didn't know what, you know, it was happening so fast. And they passed that because basically Ron Paul voted with the Democrats to gut the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would have made it a violation of the Federal Civil Rights Act to call Israel a racist state, or to compare leaders of Israel with the Nazis. So all that was taken out. And I'm appreciative of that. I think what we're seeing here in the state of California is an effort to sneak it into legislation here. Now, they haven't said that they want to do that, but I think they did tip their hand today when Don Addis, one of the co-authors, said they're going to amend this a lot before it sees the floor of the Senate.
Yeah, and the idea, you know, the idea that if you're anti-apartheid, or anti-Zionist, which is an apartheid system, and in fact, it's written into the Constitution now and interpreted into the Constitution by court decisions in Israel. The idea that you can't talk about that is pretty ludicrous, isn't it? And when we talk, and this has been especially acute on college campuses, the whole idea of academic freedom, the whole idea of people being allowed, students being allowed, faculty being allowed to put forth, oh, sometimes troubling notions, sometimes notions that a lot of people don't agree with, challenging ideas. I mean, Albert Einstein was asked, as were a number of other prominent Jews at the time Israel was being formed and becoming a country, was asked if he'd like to be and would be the leader of Israel, the new country of Israel. And he said, I'm anti-Zionist. I wouldn't want to be part of a country that discriminated against people in that fashion. But for some college student to stand up now and say that on a college campus somehow becomes anti-Semitic. I mean, it's just ludicrous. It shows the strength of the Israeli lobby. And speaking of strength, this is a moment, it seems to me, where the integrity and courage of educators, union members, organizers are certainly being tested. So I wonder, Marcy Winograd, what's your call to action? Where are you finding hope in this fight against AB 715 and in the broader crackdown on political speech, not only on our college campuses, but really everywhere when it comes to this matter of Israel?
Thank you for that excellent question. I think in the long term, the answer is non-cooperation with censorship. Teachers should not cooperate with this. I mean, let there be an anti-Semitism czar who's going to try to police content. Good luck with that, you know. Already we see teachers pushing back on edicts being handed down in their schools, in their school districts, to not talk about Palestine. And it is chilling speech to a degree, but not everybody is wearing duct tape these days. And we need to encourage these voices within the schools. And we need to support our teachers' unions as they embark on this journey of surfacing the truth, of insisting on academic freedom. And I'm really proud of United Teachers of Los Angeles in carving this path, in standing for academic freedom, in supporting real education, higher level education, critical thinking. And so in the short term, the call is call your assembly person, call your state senate person. I'm talking state, California. Tell them you want them to vote no on AB 715 because, number one, it exceptionalizes anti-Semitism without defining it. It's a backdoor attempt to define it as Zionism, as anti-Zionism. It exceptionalizes anti-Semitism above and beyond concern over other racism, anti-Blackness, racism toward Latinos. This is racist. Can't allow this to happen. And if it does, we shouldn't cooperate.
Who are some of the individuals, if you can share that with us this afternoon, who are a few of the key individuals, perhaps, that our listeners, if they're so inclined, might want to call and express their opinions about 715 too?
Yes. So a lot of this emanates from one caucus in the California State Legislature, and that is the Legislative Jewish Caucus. I like to call it the Legislative Israel Caucus or Zionist Caucus because these are all Zionist lawmakers. They have been in existence for, I don't know, maybe a decade. They have a history of they wanted to establish a statewide enemies list, the Attorney General, to establish an enemies list of Israel boycotters. This was about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And we fought this, a coalition of us up and down the state of California fought this successfully. So that never happened. They used to fly an Israeli flag from their state web portal. They are pushing Holocaust education to, you know, basically push out the Anti-Defamation League, conflating their lessons, conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. And they are pushing this bill as well, AB 715. And who are the chairs? This is a caucus that is co-chaired by Jesse Gabriel, who is an assembly member who represents Encino, the San Fernando Valley, as well as Scott Weiner, who represents San Francisco. He's a state senator. So they co-chair the Legislative Jewish Caucus, and they also co-chair each budget committee in the state legislature. So Gabriel, he chairs the budget committee in the assembly, and Weiner chairs the budget committee in the Senate, state Senate. And lawmakers walk around in fear. They are fearful of crossing them. If Weiner and Gabriel are behind a bill and a lawmaker crosses them, they may not get their bill voted on or budgeted. And you see Rivas, the speaker of the assembly, Robert Rivas from Salinas. He represents Salinas and Watsonville, a very poor area. He is, you know, in the pocket of the Israel lobby as well, because none of this rule breaking, none of the backdoor dealing for this AB 715 would have occurred if it had not been for Rivas's cooperation as the speaker of the assembly. And you have also the president pro tem of the state Senate, Mike McGuire from Marin, and he is very much in the pocket of the Israel lobby as well. And you might say, well, why is everyone in the pocket? And, you know, look, the Israel lobby is organized. They have a lot of money and they have talent and smarts. Okay. They know how to organize. And so they corral the votes in each house of the state legislature to elect the speaker, to elect the president pro tem.
So would it make sense then to target Gabriel and Wiener?
Yeah, absolutely. And Rivas and McGuire. And also, here's something I haven't mentioned that I should mention.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the co-chairs of what they call the diversity caucuses. So the co-chair of the Latino caucus, Lena Gonzalez, Long Beach, the co-chair of the Black caucus, Akilah Weber Pearson. She also is a co-author of this bill, as is Gonzalez. Right. And the co-chair of the Asian American Pacific Islander, Mike Fong from Alhambra, who represents Alhambra, he is also a co-author on this bill. So you can see how difficult this will be to defeat. But even if we don't defeat it, we will educate people, and we will stand by educators, and we will support them when they demand intellectual freedom in their classrooms.
Well, there's some question about the constitutionality of the bill. I mean, the vagueness of the language alone that we talked about earlier would seem to suggest to any lawyers who might be listening that the bill can be challenged if passed in terms of what constitutes a violation of the bill. I mean, but it's meant to be broad, but because they really can't identify things in a way that doesn't expose where they're really coming from, they end up with this vague language in the hopes that that will be a net that catches everybody who dares to say any criticism of Israel. It's as though during Vietnam, you couldn't say anything about what the U.S. government was doing in Vietnam. You were, of course, un-American if you did that. Even when 72%, 75% of the country was with you. Was it un-American to be wanting to save the lives of the Vietnamese or the lives of American soldiers? I mean, if you can't criticize a government without being accused of somehow insulting the people who make up that government, then Israel has a blank check to ever do whatever it always wants to do, because it's a nation of 85% Jewish people. You'd never be able to criticize it under the theory that, well, they're Jewish people. They can't say a word about what Israel's doing. It's a ludicrous position. It's a position, though, you're quite right, that the Israeli lobby has been very effective in not only getting into legislation, but getting into the body politic mind of the people in this country. I mean, that's what's going on in college campuses now. That's why they're picking up people on the streets, like the woman from Bard. It's not from Bard, but the Turkish woman they picked up on the streets.
I can't keep it straight, you know, but there are so many.
There's so many of them, yeah. I court today, and I can't think of where this dude was up, just released one of these people, ordered his release. Yeah. He had been picked up for the same way, simply because he had dared to speak out against what Israel was doing. Mind you, the whole world is speaking out against it. International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, everybody's speaking out against it. But somehow an American college campus, where you're supposed to enjoy freedom of speech and the whole idea of academic freedom, you can't speak out against it. It's ludicrous.
Well, we are just about. I have to say that I have been tempted. I am retired. I've been retired for almost 8 years, okay, to take care of my grandma. But I am tempted to go back to class and teach a lesson on the International Court of Justice's ruling that Israel has committed a plausible case of genocide, and have the argument from Israel and the argument from South Africa, and see if anybody comes after me. I think it's a great opportunity to test the waters.
Well, it is, and so far the courts have been pretty good on some of these issues, I might add. How long that is sustained and what the Supreme Court will do, of course, is always anybody's guess. I'm sorry, though. I know you wanted to ask a couple of last questions, and I'm taking too much time. Go ahead, Maria.
Oh, no. Actually, we are running out of time. So I guess just in 30 seconds, I did have one last question, which was, you know, for people who are maybe a parent, just in 30 seconds, you know, why should they care about, maybe they don't care about what's international politics or anything else, but why should they care about what their children learn? And then, of course, where can listeners find out more about you and your work and AB 715?
Thank you. So parents should care about this, because this speaks to the issue of academic freedom, intellectual freedom. And if we censor one subject, what's to stop us? What's to stop the state of California from censoring many subjects? This is in line with Trump's crackdown on public education. It's really the beginning of the evisceration of public education in California, as we see a crackdown on educators who really just want to talk about what everybody's watching on their cell phones, right? So, you know, students are saying, why aren't we talking about this? This is what we're seeing on TikTok, on Instagram. So the point is, speak up, call your assembly person, call your state senator, no on AB 715, stop the censorship. We want our children to be educated. Now, where to find out more about it? I have articles. I had just wrote an article. I check it out on LA Progressive on AB 715, vote no on AB 17. LA Progressive also archives a lot of my articles. I've written extensively about the Israel lobby in California, so go there. And you can also read about read my articles on the Code Pink blog.
All right. Well, my goodness, Thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much.
You know, well, no, Martha Winograd, your work as well as joining us here today on the Lawyers Guild Show. We thank you for both, and we'll follow this issue, and no doubt we'll be hearing from you again.
I hope so, and thank you so much.
Oh, no. Now we have to take a brief station on ID. Don't go anywhere, folks. We're going to be back with another topic you don't hear from on corporate radio.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM KPFK, radio powered by the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace.
Well, we are back with you with a short break. We're right back with you. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall. And now in this last half hour of the show, we're going to talk about a subject that is not always talked about this directly on. Certainly you don't hear it on corporate media. I don't know that I've ever heard it on another public radio station. That's something that should be talked about more and more. If we're truly a station that wants to cover all the ideas that are bubbling out there and that are affecting how society is performing, I'm referring to the fact that since the election of President Donald Trump, it has served, among other things, and most of them not good, but it has served to spur membership in a number of democratic socialist and socialist parties and groupings in the United States, as the actions of that administration have laid bare the contradictions and shortcomings of capitalism. I mean, there's something so open and naked about what Trump is doing, and it goes way beyond accepting a $400 million airplane flying out of the air, so that all of this is becoming more specifically clear to people, if you will. Now, while specific numbers fluctuate, a significant portion of young Americans, particularly millennials and Gen Z, hold very positive views of socialism. In fact, a Gallup poll in 2018 found that 51% of those aged 18 to 29 had a positive view of socialism, compared with only 45% of that same age group who had a positive feelings about capitalism. And more recent data, such as that from the Pew Research Center, shows that 41% of all adults under 50, not just 29, but under 50, 41% have a now positive view of socialism. And that's despite the fact that for as long as I've been alive in this country, the government, one government, Republican, Democrat, whoever it might be, are constantly railing against the threat of communism, the threat of socialism. And Trump, of course, is always talking about how he's got to get rid of all those socialists and communists and left radicals. So we've invited a spokesperson for one of the fastest growing socialist parties in America to join us here on the Lawyers Guild show today in order to talk to us about the unusually fast growth in their membership numbers and to learn, well, what their party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, or the PSL, as they are commonly known, stands for. How does the PSL operate on behalf of its socialist beliefs? What are those beliefs? Well, our guest for this is Eduardo Lalo Vargas. Now, Mr. Vargas is a high school science teacher. He's a tenants' rights organizer. He's a member of the Party, of course, for Socialism and Liberation. In 2024, last year, Mr. Vargas was one of the candidates running for City Council District 14 against Kevin DeLeon, who had come under disgrace. Eduardo Vargas is also a member of and an organizer for United Teachers of Los Angeles. Speaking, of course, just simply for himself today. And we welcome you, Edward Lalo Vargas, a warm, warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Eduardo, your party's website states, and I quote, the only solution to the deepening crisis of capitalism is the socialist transformation of society. What do you contend demonstrates that deepening crisis of capitalism?
Thanks for the question, Jim. There's so many different crises that we're seeing in our world today. Myself, I teach environmental science to high schoolers, and I think the environmental crisis is one of the major ones that we all feel, especially in Los Angeles, where we just experienced these devastating wildfires, which were exacerbated by the climate catastrophe. And these climate catastrophes are happening all over the country and all over the world. We've seen the disastrous response of the government after Hurricane Helene, and there's certainly going to be more to come in the near future as global warming and global climate change intensifies. Another crisis is global war. We see that most people don't want wars, don't want the United States to be at war, yet our government continues to fund foreign military interventions at the expense of the working class here in the United States on our dollar, but they're really fighting for the interests of corporations and the wealthy few. And so the last crisis that I would mention is the crisis of AI and how artificial intelligence is going to affect all of our workplaces, all of our job security, all of the things that we really depend on to survive. And these are just some of the major crises. But of course, at the local level, they play out in a multitude of different ways. Folks are struggling with the cost of living, with housing, with so many different struggles that our current government and our current system doesn't seem to have the answer to. I mean, we live in one of the wealthiest societies on the planet, and yet we still see homelessness. We still see kids going hungry. We still see cuts to our education system. And that is a major contradiction that the politicians who are currently in power don't seem to have a real answer to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Well, Eduardo, the PSL's website also says, and I quote, for tens of millions of workers in the United States, conditions of life and work are worsening. And, quote, there is no prospect that the situation can or will be turned around under the existing system, that is, capitalist system. Do you not believe workers, unions, and capitalist America can turn the situation around?
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring up the role of labor movement and labor unions in the United States. Historically, the labor movement has been where working class people advance their rights, where they secure their rights. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that. I mean, we've never been a population which is waiting for someone from the top to give us our rights. It's these changes that actually transform our lives have never really come from politicians, but it has come from the strength of organizing, from having a strong, militant labor movement that has a clear program, that knows what we're fighting for, and that is going to fight to defend the dignity of workers. And you know, workers represent the vast majority of our population in the United States. Small business owners who have to clock into work to ensure that their livelihoods stay afloat, they're also working. And I think it's we stand in huge contrast to the Jeff Bezos, the Elon Musks of the world, who are squandering their billions and billions of dollars on pet projects like being launched into space or building, you know, these far out fantasies of like building their own shelters on Mars. Really, these are wastes of our resources that should belong to us as workers. Our biggest power, our biggest strength is that we run all of society. We're already the ones who are taking care of the sick, We are educating the children. We are driving the trucks, in charge of transportation and construction. We build all of the things that we see around us, and yet we're not in control of how they're actually, what use they're serving. Are they going to serve the needs of the people, or are they serving the financial interests of the wealthy few? And I think that's the question that's really facing us. But under the capitalist system, if we're not able to really wrest the power away from the hands of the corporations, of the wealthy few, especially when we consider how deep their pockets go in terms of lobbying and in terms of getting what they want in the policy space, legally, the conclusion that we come to is that we live in a system that is completely dictated by billionaires and by money. And so we have to take that power away from them and put political and economic power in the hands of the working class. Right now, even in the Electoral College, we don't have one person, one vote. This is a basic democratic principle, and we don't have access to that right in this country. So there will need to be significant changes, although I do feel we can gain some momentum and we can gain some rights under the capitalist system, we're going to need much deeper transformation if we're to really see the types of changes that are going to last and that are going to address the three crises that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, your point, too, about unions, certainly. But I'm thinking back 60 years ago when I was in law school, unions represented about 35% of the American workers and were quite effective at keeping up with increases in productivity, increases in profits of the corporate sector. Still at a harsh disadvantage, but at least not losing ground every year. That was then, this is now. Today, you've got 11% of the workers in America in any kind of a union, thanks to both Democratic and Republican administrations who have one after another passed legislation which has taken away the organizing rights of workers to form unions. And of those 11%, for that matter, 6% of them are in the public sector. They're not in manufacturing. They're not in the base of what people depend on every day for getting to work or building their homes or whatever. Well, in any event, Eduardo, I'm wondering, because your website goes on to state, and here again I quote, the idea that the capitalist grip on society and their increasingly repressive state can be abolished through any means other than a revolutionary overturn is an illusion, close quote. Why do you contend that this is the case? And why do you call, and when you speak of a revolutionary overturn, are you speaking a violent revolution or something else?
Yeah, that's a great point to bring up. And I want to start by analyzing specifically the conditions that we have in the United States. You laid out really wonderfully how not so wonderfully our union membership rates have decreased. And it's very true for myself. I'm in a public sector union with UTLA. And the reality is we need more teachers, more workers to be represented by unions. And there absolutely has been a bipartisan effort to remove as many of the reforms that we have won as possible. And that's certainly a target of the Trump administration currently as well. And I know that there has been movement around passing legislation like the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, opposing things like right to work laws. But the reality is that under the capitalist system, we're consistently backed into a corner where we have to continue to negotiate our own exploitation. And so unions do provide a training ground for socialism, for the socialist project, which we propose as an alternative to the system. And to get there, it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of organizing. Folks will have to really realize what their collective power really looks like. And one of the main ways that people have done that is through the labor movement, because you win by organizing directly. You win power back. You win rights back from the bosses. They're forced to give concessions because we either threaten a strike or, you know, we do other tactics to build pressure that eventually forces their hand. But really, no no boss, no billionaire is going to willingly give up their wealth that they have amassed. And this whole legal system really is designed to protect their right to private property, their right to make immeasurable profits that were previously unimaginable to human society. And I've seen, you know, different rates, but some estimates say that to make the same level of wealth as Jeff Bezos, a minimum wage worker would have to work for 68,000 years. And so that is the scale of wealth that we're, the scale of inequality that we're talking about. And I don't think that the billionaire class will give this up quietly. I do think that there would need to be legal pressure, but that switch would have to happen because the many millions of working people in the United States have finally decided that they're taking power into their own hands. I don't believe that a revolution in the United States, a revolutionary process, would have to be violent. Because, again, our conditions in the United States are different from other countries that have had similar processes, like Vietnam, like China, like Cuba. These countries were also undergoing decades of colonialism, or centuries in some cases of colonialism, which forced them to take on very violent tactics against the colonial oppressors and then those who sought to exploit them. I don't think we have that situation in the United States. We're already a very developed country. We have industry. We have resources. We previously had more industry in the United States. And so there really isn't a need to violently do away with those people in the same way that those other countries did. However, to them, it may seem violent. For example, if a socialist government came into power tomorrow and said, we're going to nationalize the top 100 corporations, Walmart and Apple and ABC, and all of these corporations are now going to be property of the U.S. government. I believe that they would be run by the people, the working class people. I do believe that, you know, the billionaire class would resist that. And so we would need a movement of working people, just like how we've seen the labor movement do, how we've seen tenants' rights movements, immigrants' rights movements. These movements can topple down existing orders without a single bullet being shot. So I really think that that's the pathway for us, especially as socialists and for those of us who want real change in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, the PSL website also says that the fundamental problems confronting humanity today flow from the reality that most of the world's productive wealth, the product of socialized labor and nature, is privately owned and controlled by a tiny minority, which you were just speaking about. Can you explain that statement?
Yeah. When we place an order on Amazon for, say, some tools or something, those tools have passed through many dozens, if not hundreds of hands, from the manufacturing point to transportation, to the warehouse, to then getting delivered at our doorstep. So the way we produce things on a global scale and the way we move around goods in the economy is already a socialized process. Again, all of us together collectively, we're the ones who are running society, and we all play a role. And yet those profits from that service, from that product, from the manufacturing, isn't being evenly distributed amongst all of the different people that are in that chain. All of the profits are being usurped or taken away and being used for investors, for the people at the top. And there's really no reason why they should be the only ones controlling or dictating what our society needs. I remember right after COVID ended, seeing headlines about how Abbott, one of the labs that produced COVID tests, was just burning tests or throwing them away or putting them in the garbage because it was more profitable to them to just throw them away than to just distribute them for free. And these are the sort of contradictions that we've seen time and time again under our system. We've seen, you know, how farmers will throw away food, excess food. So our crisis really is in the United States not one of scarcity, but one of overabundance, And what we're lacking in really is organization and what folks really need. And I'll give an example. In Los Angeles, currently, there's tens of thousands of homeless individuals living on the streets. But because housing is commodified and it's not a human right, investors use housing as speculation. And some estimates place the number of empty housing units that are just sitting on the market as being greater than the number of homeless people on the streets. So if say, a socialist system were to come into power, they would take those empty units and give them to the people so that no one would have to be homeless. No one would have to suffer that sort of situation. So there's a lot of contradictions in our current system, and it's because things are managed only for the sake of profit, not the needs of people, not the needs of the planet, or what's going to benefit our communities, our families, and our well-being in the long run.
You know, Eduardo, I understand that the membership in the PSL, and this is perhaps true for a number of other organizations that are socialist as well, but certainly I understand that in the case of the PSL, your membership has really grown many times larger just in the last couple of years. What do you think accounts for that? And is it mostly young people who are joining? Talk to us a bit about the growth and membership of the PSL, what you attributed to and who these folks are and why it's happening.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up. There's just folks are still hungry for an alternative to the two-party system. Even though we definitely encourage our politicians, our elected officials to pass progressive reforms, a lot of people will see through that. They see that it's not enough quite anymore. We've seen betrayals from those in the Democratic Party. We saw how the Bernie Sanders campaign really, really took off. And Bernie Sanders played a really important role for the socialist movement in the United States, because previously it was thought that the United States was the most anti-socialist, anti-communist country in the whole world. And, you know, anti-socialism, anti-communism is sort of the unofficial religion of the United States. And that goes way back to the post-war era, the Cold War era. And so now that, you know, seeing two of the Bernie Sanders campaigns where he demystified what socialism really was, he made socialism popular again. It really allowed this new generation to really tap into what I believe is our previously broken consciousness. You know, the country has seen social movements like those of the 1930s. We've seen movements like the anti-Vietnam War movement, and the civil rights movement. These have all been very important key transitions in the United States where the working class, and in particular the youth, are coming to consciousness. But after each of these movements has succeeded in whatever their demands were, the ruling class parties, the Democrats, Republicans, they sort of collaborated in shattering that memory of struggle, of organization, of what it means to really fight and be active in politics. And for a long time, I think people felt that, you know, politics isn't for them. It's something that, you know, other people do, people with money do. But the PSL has grown because now people see past that. They see past the myth. The veil of anti-socialism has been really lifted. If someone as mainstream as Bernie Sanders can declare themselves a socialist on national television and then garner $3 million in small donations practically overnight, it shows that people are ready for really a dramatic departure from the system that we currently know. So we are seeing a lot of enthusiasm right now from young people, but also people who are maybe are distancing themselves from the two mainstream parties for the first time in their whole lives. I know that I talked about the good of the Bernie campaign, but on the other hand, you know, folks have seen how the Democratic Party was unwilling to touch his politics with a 10-foot pole. We didn't really get anything in exchange for Bernie Sanders giving up his candidacy. And so I think, understandably, a lot of folks are seeing the Democratic Party as the dead end for progressive movements. They want to build an alternative. And the PSL has been in the streets, in our neighborhoods, really doing one-on-one grassroots community work. You know, we do something called deep canvassing, where we really go into different communities where we have members, you know, members who are typically from those communities as well, who are from the working class, and can talk to people one-on-one about the issues that matter to them. And then we fight alongside the community, whether it's around school closures, police brutality, you know, different issues that face the working class. We're there to support and teach people how to organize and how to be empowered, and how politics isn't some far-off thing. It's something that affects each and every one of us, and we all deserve and have the right to play a role in the politics in our lives. And so that's how we've been building this alternative, and we've experienced a lot of growth. As you said, you know, we have branches now in every state in the country. We're in most major cities, and if we're not in a major city yet, then we're definitely planning and organizing and how to get there. We've been building a lot in the South as well. You know, the South, as the African-American Black stronghold in the United States, is a key area to organize in because of the oppression, the history of oppression that has taken place in the South, but also because the Black community has historically been the detonator, or, you know, the leaders of any sort of progressive movement that has made meaningful change in this country. And, you know, I'm just thinking to Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and the type of movements that they led. We're certainly seeing a revival of that energy, of that consciousness now. And so I think if folks want to join, you know, our door is wide open. And that's why people have been coming to us. And they see themselves in the party, because we're fighting for those issues that matter to them.
Well, Eduardo, we are...
Oh, I'm sorry. Just quickly before, yeah, because I guess we are running out of time, Maria.
Yes.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. No, I was just going to say we have only about 1 minute left. So can you please tell us very briefly your connection with the Answer Coalition and the PSL, and then tell listeners how they can learn more about the PSL?
Yes. So the Answer Coalition was started 2 days after the September 11th attacks as a response to the increasing threats of war from the United States. It's an anti-war movement, and it's a coalition of many organizations, of which PSL is one organization. So we certainly support ANSWER in all of their actions and all of their demands to say, you know, abolish NATO. You know, with so many threats of global war that we're currently seeing, especially with Ukraine, you know, war against China and so on. Folks can find out more about the ANSWER Coalition at answercoalition.org, at answer.org, my bad. And then they can follow the PSL on PSL_Los Angeles or PSL National on all socials. And our website is PSL.org.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we so appreciate you coming on the Lawyers Guild show today and explaining what you have very articulately and very straightforwardly. We really appreciate having you with us today, Eduardo Lalo Vargas. Thank you, and good luck to your work in the future.
Thank you so much. I appreciate so much being here. Thank you.
All right. Goodbye for now. Well, okay, we managed to get it all in. We had a lot to cover today, but we managed, I think, to get it all in pretty much. We do just have a minute or so left. The fun drive is over. No, the music is playing. I can't hear it. All right, there it goes. Well, you've been listening to the Lawyers Guild show today. We're going to be back with you. We're back with you again next Wednesday, of course, at 3 o'clock, same time. Until then, on behalf of Maria Hall, myself, Jim Lafferty, we thank you for listening to the Lawyers Guild show today. We urge you to stay healthy, my friends, and to stand up for your rights.
I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an art that needs a scroll. After story had never been told. So now...
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
That's what is good about KPFK. You do get it that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk. But it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from